This is Backstory, the show that takes a topic from the here and now and plumbs its historical depths. I'm Peter Onuf, your guide to the 18th century.
I'm Ed Ayers, your guide to the 19th century.
And I'm Brian Bellow, guide to whatever's left over. Today on the show, we're taking on some of the spirits, witches, and other supernatural phenomena that have haunted the American past. We're also taking on some of the listeners who have been haunting the Backstory website.
Hey, guys, we have a call from Tiffany in Chicago. Tiffany, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So, what's on your mind or moving your spirit, as the case may be today?
Well, I'm wondering if you can comment on some ideas that I've read about regarding the Salem witch trials.
Okay, the Salem witchcraft. What about it?
Well, I've read a little bit about how some of the women who were accused of witchcraft were... they were often wealthy or unmarried or kind of out of the norm of the regular role of women at the time.
Right. Well, there have been lots and lots of books written about Salem witchcraft with lots of different explanations. Many of them center, as you have, Tiffany, on the question of marginality or the fancy word liminality, people who are in but not of the community, who are othered, as the expression goes, who are identified as alien and foreign, whether they are ethnically different. And, of course, Tituba was a West Indian slave. She's the source, supposedly, of some of the magic lore and the accusations. And it's really a fascinating question why this one community should be the site for this outbreak and for the subsequent conviction of all these witches. But maybe the most important thing to keep in mind is that everybody believes in white and black magic in this period, practically everybody. In other words, when you make this accusation, it's really reflecting an explanation for things that happened that makes sense. So in a way, I think we over-explain witchcraft because we want to translate it into 21st century terms and say, what would make us do something like this? Is it generational strife? Is it the search for some scapegoat or something? Or is it ergotism, something
that's what I think. The LSD and the grain.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, guys. Could someone tell me what ergotism is?
The thesis is that there was a sort of a fungus, I believe, that was in the wheat of Salem at this time, and it literally had a mind-altering capacity. I think this obviously bears the marks of its time of argument. I don't think this is taken too seriously now.
No, that's right.
But it is, you know, as Peter was saying, the idea that we can reduce this sort of past belief into something social seems to be a kind of a modern reductionism, you know? And obviously people are just setting aside the obvious argument that, in fact, there were witches, you know? And of course, from the viewpoint of the time, there were. You know, that's just a category that we don't believe exists anymore, you know?
So, Tiffany, can I steal a little of your caller time and ask the guys when we stopped believing in witches?
Sure. Mm. I would like to know that, too.
So it's the 18th century, right, Peter?
Is it the 18th century?
Yeah. I think in a serious way, an idea of modern Christianity began to dominate in pulpits throughout New England and British America. And there was a movement away from magical explanation and an effort to suppress the idea that there were still crazy things, miraculous things happening in our midst, and an effort to understand God's creation in what we would call rationalistic terms.
So it was, in a way, empowering God.
Yeah, I think so. That's the big move from a kind of a God and spirits who are immanent in everyday life to a more distant clockmaker God.
Yeah. But Peter, I mean, the whole context of witchcraft was Christianity, though, right?
Yeah. No, that's true.
So, I mean, so it wasn't really just the rise of Christianity.
Oh, no, I meant this, the triumph of what we could recognize as modern Christianity. And I think, as you're suggesting, Ed, we exaggerate the difference. The mystical, magical elements are still very prevalent in many branches of modern Christianity. So I don't want to exaggerate the difference. It's just there was a campaign from the pulpits to suppress magic and magical beliefs.
Well, you know, thinking back from the perspective of the South, which we would think would be a place, if you didn't really know much about American history, you would think it would be the most folkloric part of the nation and would be especially susceptible to this. Of course, the South prided itself. In fact, Virginia looked down on New England because it seemed especially prone to stuff like, I mean, that was main way to explain abolitionism and feminism away. These are the people who also believed that there were witches. Yeah. No, really, it's true.
No, that's right. But I just want to make a defense of my native New England ancestors.
I'm not attacking them.
Okay.
I'm just conveying.
I don't want to take this too personally, but I'm very upset with what.
No, yeah, that's all right.
Yeah, and
I'll
that
just
is,
dunk you.
You
man.
Know what Salem is all about, Tiffany, and guys.
Yes.
What Salem's all about is the legal system operating to sort out the evidence and to convict.
Yeah.
We focus on the irrational beliefs, the stupidity of these people, but what's remarkable is the way
they go about it.
They go about it.
Yeah.
That is, they had institutions, legal institutions, state institutions that were capable of doing this. And of course, there was a great mourning after, a kind of, well, you know, we shouldn't have done that.
Right.
But it was the legal system in yes. conjunction with popular beliefs that produced these results.
Yeah, you know, the only thing we have in the 20th century, Tiffany, that comes close to that is NFL replay.
Oh, how about the World Cup, man?
Well, you know,
they don't have that.
They don't have
it. That's exactly
my point.
But this is very amusing, but I do believe you've had witch trials in your own century, Brian. I'm thinking about Army McCarthy here.
Right. Very interesting.
Right, right.
Why do we call them witch trials or witch hunts? Why is that the analogy that we use?
Well, I think that what these witch hunts imply is exactly what you guys were talking about. It's going back to all those fancy words that Peter used. Let's leave ergotism out. But there was liminal, there was marginality.
Yeah.
And if, in fact, those were the types of people that made for good witches, then the witch hunts of the 20th century against communists, for the most part, were people who were seen as marginal but insidiously blending in with the regular population. And we needed witch hunts in order to sort them out.
Well, see, and I think that another implication of witch hunt is that to look is to find, right? That's the idea, is that we're going to go out and we're going to find the source of an evil that we're imagining. And to actually look for that person is to guarantee you're going to find them.
Right. Yeah.
And I think, too, it has a lot in common with conspiracy theorists today. There's a fixation on evidence.
Yeah.
Right.
And a fixation on suppressed evidence.
That's
as
right.
Well.
Exactly. That's right. So, you know, there's something about the witch hunt that's deeply American, I think. It's empirical. It's not mystical.
Yeah.
You know, it's legalistic. Yeah. No, it's not folkish.
And what's very American, it's a group activity. It's almost always involves the collective.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So, Tiffany, I mean, you've really conjured up, you know, cauldron of perplexing questions.
Are you implying an accusation here?
All I'm saying is there's a strong hint of an eye of Newt around here, if you know what I mean.
Well,
would that be coming from you, Tiffany?
You are a bewitching caller, Tiffany, and thank you so much for...
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much,
Bye-bye.
Tiffany.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
We're going to take another call now, and it's going to be from Elena out in Exeter, California. Elena, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you very much.
What's on your mind?
Well, I know that the safest stance for historians and educated people is to take the debunking stance and to seek a rational, scientific, or psychological explanation.
We don't debunk here. We rebunk.
You rebunk, okay.
Or we just bunk, yeah.
Well, which century would be the most likely to find someone who is actually trying to connect and to learn about the unseen and the unknown and not try to prove that these incidences are fake?
Oh, we're all raising our hands here, and we're
all claiming it.
Yeah, well,
we're all pointing.
We're going to let Ed, Mr. 19th century.
Yeah, we think the answer is easy.
Well, which is always a dangerous sign.
Exactly.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm thinking about, which is the creation of the American Society for Psychical Research, which took place in the 1890s, which is the perfect overlap between sort of the birth of what we would think of as professional social science and medicine with a realization that the more you learn, the more that there might be to learn. And so really one of my favorite people in all of American history, William James, that we think of mm-hmm. as a father of pragmatism. Mm-hmm. And he was the leader in all of this. And, you know, he said, look, why would we rule out that there are dimensions of experience that we cannot understand, that we cannot see? He said, scientists are discovering all over the place that there are elements of the physical world that are invisible to us. So he actually risked quite a bit in his career to sponsor people who were claiming that they could communicate with and see elements of the psychic world. So I think it's at the pivot of the 19th to the 20th century, the combination of new means of exploring people and physical phenomena with a belief coming off the great century of spiritualism.
Yeah, I mean,
but by this time, you'd had a half century of spiritualism being taken for granted as something that's worthy of serious consideration. So to answer your question, it actually has a fairly clear answer, and I would say it's in the 1890s, the first decade of the 20th century.
Well, Elena, I'm not going to argue with Ed. We always defer to him on this program. He's a very dominant guy. But what William James is doing is really a culmination of a long buildup. The spiritualism actually is deeply rooted in the Scottish Enlightenment in the 18th century, and it's the combination of looking for explanations with a new kind of scientific worldview, but that accepts the reality of other dimensions. I'll just give you one example, because all I know about is Thomas Jefferson. But Thomas Jefferson is a materialist who believes that we continue in some form after life.
He did?
Yeah. It was, for me, very difficult to come to terms with this whole notion of materialism that's established in European philosophy of the endurance of matter and therefore a kind of eternity. It's only in the modern period that for most scientists, we live in a disenchanted world. And they'll say, oh, yes, you can have faith and believe in stuff that we can't explain, but that's different. That's a very modern idea, isn't it, Brian?
Yes, I think that's right, Peter. But being 20th century guy and coming from the therapeutic century, Elena, I need to ask you how you feel about all of this. And more specifically, what brings you to this question?
Ooh.
I have had experiences, both the group type of experience with Ouija boards, levitation of tables, that I went into the experiences very, very skeptical, but my own actual experience of seeing it and of getting knowledge and guidance that was beyond the scope of the people who were actually doing it, mm-hmm. that was one. And the other experience that I had personally was at the death of somebody that I greatly respected, experiencing automatic writing and channeling of her voice.
You need to explain automatic writing to me.
Okay. Yeah. I was actually in the room where she died several hours before she died. I would go sit in this room with a piece of paper, and I would be, I wouldn't say asleep or in a trance state, but I wouldn't be thinking consciously about what I was writing. It would almost be going through me as I was writing it, and I wasn't aware of it until I would read it later. And it was in her voice and in her style of talking. And I never have really fully understood it. It was a wonderful way to reconnect, and people that have tried to explain it have said, you know, that was your grief or that whatever, or that was the part of her that you incorporated. And all of that could be true. But also at the time, right before her death, when I went into the room, there were a lot of people that loved her in the room. I was aware of, I don't know how to describe it, but I was aware of the presence of other beings in a way that I haven't been since. I think a lot of people have had that kind of experience, you know, a cold chill through the room,
sure,
or whatever, and maybe laughed it off or tried to deny it. But this experience before Betty, her name was Betty Diederich, and before she died, was walking into a room and just feeling these incredible presences.
Well, I wanted to say that while the 20th century clearly can't claim the peak position for this serious inquiry into the spiritual. There are spiritual organizations that live on. And earlier this morning, I went to a website for the National Spiritualist Association of Churches. And I'll just read you a little poem from the beginning of one of the sermons on their website. I believe that when you die, your life goes on. It doesn't end here when you're gone. Every soul is filled with light. It never ends, and if I'm right, our love can even reach across eternity. I believe, I believe. So there's a little shout out for the National Spiritualist Association of Churches. And so you're not alone out there.
Well, that is good to hear.
Thank you so much, Elena.
Oh, thank you. I love your show, and I really, really appreciate your taking my call.
Thanks, Elena.
Bye-bye.
Guys, I have a confession. I did not want to do this show, and it has something to do with personal belief. I have very little brief for spiritualism. But listening to you, I have come to appreciate the great importance of people's yearning to communicate and to transcend the media that is commonplace in their lives and the people who they can actually see. And I'm going to confess for the 20th century, I think Halloween is a pretty pale version of dealing with the really serious set of issues of death, of yearning, and distance that you, Peter, and Ed have been discussing during the show along with some of our callers. So I apologize on behalf of the 20th century version of dealing with these issues.
You know, and I guess I'd like to put in a word for your century, Brian. And
thank you,
silly,
Ed.
Can
I sing Kumbaya in the background here?
Just think of it as 19th century condescending to your century is the way that I imagine it. Halloween, obviously, is a transparent commercial ploy to sell a lot of candy and stuff. But we might think, why do our children like it so much?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a way of, okay, so there's a cardboard skeleton hanging on the front door. That's a scary thing that we kind of use Halloween to tame, right? And the idea of carnival, of getting a chance to dress up like somebody else, to be scary, even though you're, you know, 5 years old or whatever. You know, I think we might cut ourselves a little bit of slack on this. Halloween may be more of a continuum, even though it's in many ways a perversion of, you know, real spiritual longing. On the other hand, it makes the unknown a little bit less frightening, and I'm not sure that's ever a bad thing.
Ed, I couldn't have said it better myself. And it's lucky you said it well, because we're once again out of time.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field and Catherine Moore. Jamal Milner mastered the show, and Gabby Alter wrote our theme. Backstory's executive producer is the very spooky Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory comes from the University of Richmond, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, committed to the idea that the future may learn from the past.
Support also comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, James Madison's Montpelier, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crowe, J.M. Weinberg, Austin Ligon, and an anonymous donor.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is a Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.